Yeah, let's do it. I'm pumped. Let's let the healing begin.
God help you if you use voiceover in your work, my friends. God help you. It's flaccid, sloppy writing.
I don't want you to be the guy in the PG-13 movie everyone's really hoping makes it happen. I want you to be like the guy in the rated R movie, you know? The guy you're not sure whether or not you like yet.
Hello and welcome to the 89th episode, or rather the second episode of the 2.0 podcast. I'm Chapin Hemingway, and joining me as always is Lee Carlo, and back for the 2.0 version for the first time, Jeremy Fisk. So today we'll be looking at the film Boyhood. We then will move on to a conversation about The Imitation Game, and then we'll wrap it all up with our top five good performances from actors we hate.
Put the barrier up!
I don't wanna be your hero. I don't wanna be a big man. I just wanna fight with
you. You guys ready to have some fun?
Yeah!
Yeah! Don't worry about it.
Wish we can use the bumpers.
You don't want the bumpers. Life doesn't give you bumpers.
So, guys, I heard an interesting quote from Ethan Hawke talking about Boyhood. And he said, talking about kind of how the movie was set up, life is interesting enough as it is. You don't need to manufacture anything. And I don't think that that is particularly true with movies. However, I do think it was the case with this. And I'm wondering if you guys agree with me. And if you do, how this movie seemed to separate itself from all other movies in that aspect.
I would just definitely disagree with Ethan Hawke if he's talking about in terms of storytelling, specifically when it comes to film, that life is interesting enough. But as far as this movie's concerned, I don't think it applies. I don't think, like, I get what he's saying, because this movie was just unbelievably enchanting when it came to sort of its storytelling style and how, you know, we all know what it was. It was, you know, a movie that took place over, what, 18 years?
12 years.
12 years. Yeah, that's even smaller, but still. But I get what he's saying, because there's nothing in this movie, which I think is great. There's nothing in this movie that's just spectacular about any sort of plot movement, or there's something that just happens and gets, you know, changes the lives of everyone forever that you just kind of
truest slice of life you can probably get.
Yeah. There's nothing you can just point to that just, you can be like, okay, this is something that I felt was contrived. And I think it really worked well for this movie, because you got to see those moments in life that everyone remembers. Those, like, little moments that are a bigger deal to that individual than maybe other things you would think it would be. It doesn't mean that in film you can just sort of go day by day in everyday life and it's going to be compelling to the audience. I mean, Linklater really knew what he was doing when he decided on what he's going to put in this film and what he's going to leave out of this film. And it's hard not to get totally swept away by the whole charm of this movie. And it was definitely my favorite film of the year.
Well, that's what I think is interesting, is and why I think we're on the same page, in that what Ethan Hawke said, that life is interesting enough as it is, you don't need to manufacture everything, that in general, you can't do that. Like, movies need to come up with something that, you know, can make life more interesting. But this movie, for some reason,
I don't know if it needs to, like, make life more interesting, but it just needs to be compelling for the audience.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be necessarily more interesting than your life or my life.
Right.
Or, you know, anyone else's life who might, you know, might
have
to
be something dramatic.
There needs to be something in the storytelling that compels an audience to want to keep watching. And whether you want to call it a gimmick, I hate that word when it comes to this film. But the way he told that story absolutely made it compelling. And there were things I could totally relate to. just watching this movie, and there's that part of everybody that just sees time slipping by. And this movie is the first film I've ever seen that was able to capture such an important part of growing up, growing older, and life. And that's why, to me, this movie was just spectacular.
Well, here's kind of the reason I was particularly intrigued by that statement, because, and I think we're all on the same page that that's not necessarily a true statement. However, I think it's apt that Ethan Hawke mentioned it in reference to Boyhood, because something that I think this movie does really well is that it kind of picks out very arbitrary elements of life and kind of pieces them all together. Like, there's never a moment in the movie where that, you know, dramatic thing happens. I've seen the movie twice now, and so the first time watching it, there were several moments in the movie where I was like, okay, this is where like something dramatic is going to happen or something bad is going to happen, and it never did. And it's so refreshing to watch, and it's so like it's so comfortable to watch when nothing bad does happen necessarily. Like, there's drama and there's challenges for all the characters, but there's not like a moment where, you know, something goes horribly wrong, or there's a death, or there's this hugely dramatic moment that has to try to drive the rest of the story forward. And I found it a really pleasing experience to watch. And I think it was interesting. And because last week, Chapin, when we were talking about Foxcatcher, you said that you like to be pleased at movies, and Foxcatcher was an unpleasant experience, which, side note, after the fact, I thought was very interesting considering the movies that you make. But that's another discussion. But I just found Boyhood a very pleasing movie to watch, and it was just an enjoyable experience. And I think that's kind of amazing, because there wasn't anything outside of just an interesting view on life, an interesting slice of life.
I agree and I disagree. I think you really hit on something when you started talking about like why it works, is there's nothing that sort of drove it as far as like driving the plot, like some sort of linchpin you can point to that you go, okay, this is happening so that we can set up this happening later. Right. But it doesn't, you also said nothing really bad happens, which isn't true. There's some terrible things that happen in this movie. There's some terrible things that happen to Patricia Arquette's character. There's some terrible things that happen to the kids. There's a couple abusive and alcoholic fathers. I mean, this is not easy stuff to deal with.
I should clarify a little bit, because there were two scenes in particular on my first viewing of this where I was like, okay, here it is. Like, and I was almost nervous that something was going to happen. The first one was the scene where they were camping out with his friends and their older brother, and they were throwing the saw blade at the board. And I was ready for it to like cut somebody, you know what I mean? Like, in this hugely dramatic, horrible thing to happen. And then
it's interesting you brought that up, because that's actually something, I don't know where I read it, but Linklater actually remembers when he watched the movie with an audience, one of the first times he ever watched it with an audience, he felt that in the theater at that scene. And he was like, oh Jesus, I didn't even think, like, he didn't even think of it like that something, but the whole audience reacted that way. Like, they're expecting.
Well, I think that's kind of the brilliance of this movie. Like, and then the other piece was when he was in school and he was in the bathroom, and the bullies just kind of started bullying him for no reason. I thought he was going to get beat up or something, but he doesn't. And I think kind of the brilliance of this movie is it a little bit that it, and it's not even like the first layer of brilliance. I think it's kind of a sub layer of it, is that it kind of plays on, you know, what movies have done to our expectations when we go to the movies. Like, we expect, you know, directors or writers or filmmakers to need this, what you call the linchpin, to, you know, keep the audience engaged and interested and to create drama. And Linklater never needs that. And I think that's just what is really smart. Like, and it's interesting that he said he didn't even think that, because I would have thought he was saying like, I know people are going to expect this to happen. Like, watch how great it is when something doesn't happen. And so, you know, I think that makes it even more interesting that wasn't even his intention to, you know, create this suspense.
Yeah. And I, I agree, but I kind of dismiss the notion that this movie was not about anything in particular, that it wasn't meant to sort of engage you and make you think and deal with some of the biggest questions that a movie can deal with. I sort of like dismiss this idea that plot and theme have to be intertwined, and that we're so like, and we're so enthralled by the fact that this movie didn't have any plot, and yet we were all so smitten by it.
That's not what I'm arguing. I mean, I'm totally with you. I think that the themes that are explored in this movie are totally, you know, topical and relevant and relatable. And I think that's what makes this movie so good. I'm not trying to suggest that it's just this movie about life where nothing happens. And it's interesting because of that, because they shot it with the same actors.
Right. And I think it's just about life. I mean, that's sort of the bottom line of it. And on that level, it works brilliantly. And there was never a point where I was like, okay, where's this going? Because I could have watched that. I could watch that till that kid, you know, turns 40 or 60, or, you know, it's just like.
So I'm glad you brought that point up, and we'll come back to it, because I kind of want to hear from Chapin a little bit, because I knew how you felt about this movie, and I think we are very much on the same page about our feelings towards it, but I want to get a little insight from Chapin. But remind me to come back to that point about being able to continue to watch these characters grow and beyond where the movie ends. Chapin, that's your cue to
say something. Yes.
Yeah.
I agree with you guys. I think that there is something, and Jeremy, I would argue that actually I think it is a gimmick in sort of the best sense of the word. And like, for those who haven't seen the movie, you know, it's the same actors for over this. The movie was shot for, you know, 12 years and with the same actors, right. And you watch these
39 days of filming. Yeah. Right. Over 12 years. Yeah.
You watch these kids grow up. They'd meet like once a year. And, you know, as a side note, I was, for some reason, I don't know why it was, but I was expecting kind of a 7-Up, 14-Up, you know, that series. I was expecting kind of, you know, vignettes like every,
okay, yeah,
every couple of years. But in fact, it was sort of brilliant about, I mean, I think that gimmick, for lack of a better word, is the most brilliant thing about this movie. And it's the reason why it's gotten so much hype, and it deserves it for that reason. But I would say, like, we as the audience watch them grow up, and we get this, you know, we get this view that you would get if you were really watching them in a truncated way, in a compressed way. But you watch these people, and you almost don't notice it. You almost don't notice them changing from scene to scene, even though there's sometimes years between cuts. And I think that gives you or gives us as the audience a different perspective that I'm not even sure how to describe. I couldn't tell you, and maybe we can go into that more. I can't tell you why that matters. I can't tell you why, if this movie were to use younger actors and then different actors when they grow up, I don't know why that would be any different, but it is. It's different.
Yeah.
I don't, like, you know, just to give my opinion of it, I don't think I like this movie as much as you guys did, but I do think that is why Boyhood is it's gotten so much praise. And this is kind, and I, you know, I went in and I thought, you know, this sounds kind of gimmicky. This sounds like almost like a marketing tactic, but it really wasn't. It was really powerful. And that, and all, everything that I got out of the movie that was positive came from that aspect of it. So I hope that makes sense.
I think it's a really, and I don't think that I have an answer for it either. And it's worth discussing, even if we can, you know, cooperatively come up with an answer, that this movie does work because of the, you know, let's use the word gimmick, just so we know we're all on the same page, because of the gimmick, in a way that it would not have worked if it was shot more with a more traditional style, with using different actors. And it is very interesting. And the I would say the first, you know, maybe half hour, 40 minutes of this movie, watching, you know, these actors, it felt so real, almost as if it was like a documentary and an inside look and almost an obtrusive look at their life, that there were times my first time around where I felt kind of uncomfortable watching it. And at first I was discouraged and frustrated by that, kind of feeling uncomfortable watching it. And that very seamlessly and quickly went away and my opinion changed. But outside of that kind of uncomfortable, you know, viewing experience that I had initially, there's nothing I can pinpoint that made this different than that traditional filmmaking style. But I mean, Chavin, you're absolutely right. Like, that is a big part of what made this movie. It is what made it kind of powerful and unique. But I can't put my finger on what it is that makes it different.
Right.
I think part of it has to do with, well, part of it, a huge, huge part of it has to do with Linklater and the temptation of what it would be if he cast different actors in those roles as they grew older. Then you'd all of a sudden, I feel like he would feel obligated to make those moments more, I don't necessarily want to say impactful, but obvious to the story. And because, hey, look, we cut, you know, a few years into the future, and now we have a different actor or actress playing this person. Now this is what happens to them at this point in life that they remember forever. But for some reason, because it's the same actor playing that person throughout those 12 years, he doesn't feel as much a need to conform to conventional cinema narrative. And instead he can kind of let it breathe and say, okay, so this moment where this little boy is moving out of his house for the first time, and his mom just happens to casually paint over the markings on the door that, you know, that as he grew taller in that house, there's just sort of like a one-off of casually painting over that. And then the boy looking at his friends or his neighbors as he drives away. Now, all of a sudden, that moment is huge. You just remember it. And if all of a sudden we cut to a different actor doing something later on, I feel like Linklater and anyone would feel the need to be like, okay, so this is the point where something really big happens. Yeah.
I think that's a good point. And if go ahead.
No, I just think that's why, like, I think that's why, I guess we're trying to figure out why it works so much to use the same actors. And I think that's why he just felt comfortable. He just felt comfortable letting life sort of breathe on film instead of having to force some sort of story to show his audience, because he has these same people every year and he's having the same experience. You got to remember, he's having the same experience in a way that we had watching it, because he's coming back to these people that he frankly doesn't know that well, other than maybe Ethan Hawke, you know, film once a week.
His daughter, so.
Well, other than his daughter. Okay, great.
But he probably knows Ethan Hawke better.
He knows Ethan Hawke more, because why not?
He's better. He's better looking.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, that quality, it really lends a freedom to it that makes that work. And that's why I feel like it works better than if he had cast different people.
I'm sorry, but Jeremy, I think you're definitely right here, but I'm wondering if you can kind of say that point from an audience perspective. Like, what about that? Can you kind of translate that into, from your point of view, from the point of view of the viewer, not necessarily Linklater's point of view? Like, what about watching what you know as the same people growing up on film essentially was powerful?
Right. Yeah, no, because from an audience point of view, you don't feel in any way, shape, or form manipulated by the story. because these are the same people. You're seeing them grow. You're not feeling like, and it's not even about those important moments or, and I think we kind of are getting a little hung up on that. Like there was those big plot points or those linchpins. It's not about those. It's that you're seeing these same people, which makes you feel sort of relaxed and like you're engaging in their lives as they're growing older, rather than if it was a different actor throughout. You're going to be, I mean, you're just going to be aware. It's natural. You're going to be aware you're being told a story, and you're not going to be able to sort of free yourself up to share those little moments with those people that you wouldn't be able to do that with if it was a different actor, because you'd be like, okay, so in the back of your mind, you're like, I know this is a different actor.
Yeah, I
so,
mean, you're like immediately disarmed by that.
Immediately disarmed, mm-hmm. and you're like, okay, so I'm seeing what they're feeling in that moment because that's what they want me to feel, instead of, oh my God, that's really happening to this person. I remember when he was 10.
Right. And I think, you know, I wonder if, you know, I mean, we should be honest. When I was studying film or whatever, and I'm sure you guys got into this too, you know, there are certain schools of teaching where you look at movies and they're just very practical, and making them is, you know, acting and directing and stuff like that is looked at very practically. It's a job, et cetera. But I mean, let's be honest, like it is an emotional pursuit one way or the other, you know, you're creating emotion. And so it's going to be different than, you know, going to work and, you know, whatever, you know, pushing buttons all day. You have to cultivate that emotion. And I think that the authenticity in the making of the movie aided that emotional mining, for lack of a better word. And you come out of it feeling like everything is authentic. To be honest with you, I do have some criticisms with the movie, and I think I think that I don't necessarily agree with everything you guys have said, but the power of this, as I said before, I think comes from that. It's something feels authentic about it. And I think that, you know, I'm sure there's a part of that process that really made it feel more authentic.
So I'll just elaborate on it a little bit, what you guys are saying, just kind of as audience members. What's great is that we don't ever have to set the reset button, you know. So if that actor changes, all of a sudden, as audience members, almost subconsciously, we have to kind of reset our expectations, kind of reset ourselves within the context of the story and figure out where we are. But because the way this movie transitions, and obviously with the same actors playing each character as they grow up, that never has to happen. And then I also think kind of what that does, spawns another discussion, but I think what it does is it takes a lot of pressure off of the actors themselves. And I think the range of performance quality in this movie, it kind of runs the gamut, but I was never bothered really by performances that were weaker in this movie because I just accepted the fact that this is who
that's
these
who
people
they
are.
Yeah.
And, you know what I mean? Like, and even some of the good act, like I think Patricia Arquette was quite good for most of the movie, but even scenes where I felt like she was struggling, I didn't look at it as a bad performance. I almost looked at it like a hard time for her, like a tough day for her. And I think that just, it's another element of the movie that isn't distracting. And it takes the pressure off the actors, and it allows us as audience members to just be more fully engaged in the movie.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, especially when it comes to... I guess I should look him up.
Eller Coltrane?
Yeah. Especially when it comes to Eller Coltrane, because I mean, I don't think if he was in a different movie, we'd be like, oh, that kid's a good actor. But in this movie, it's just, like you said, it's who he is.
Even know if I say in this movie he was a good actor. And unfortunately, I could
he
see
wasn't.
This
he
movie.
Wasn't. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. I could see this movie almost being a little bit of a detriment to his career. In the sense that, like, you know, I look at him as Mason. I don't, you know, for example, you didn't even know what his real name was. And you almost kind of understand that. Like, this was just this kid growing up. Like, we were just so involved in his life throughout the course of this movie. So I'm curious, Chapin, the faults that you found in this movie? Because for me, this is not only my favorite movie of the year, but it's one of my favorite movies in years that I've seen. Right. And it's summed up like, and kind of to bring up what I was talking about earlier, like some like little things about this movie that made it so great for me is that it ended right where it should have. Like I can totally see the argument that Jeremy brought up, and I've read about it, how, you know, you could continue to watch this movie as these people continue to grow. And I sort of understand that. And there's a part of me that even says I'd like to see how it goes on. But I also think that this movie just, it began and ended exactly where it was supposed to. And everything in the middle was just so good. And I think all of that is what makes this movie so good for me.
I was listening the other day to our Fixies from 2011. And Jeremy, you were talking about, it was the conversation in particular about Terrence Malick, and you called him best director, even though you didn't even really necessarily like that movie, or at least it wasn't in your top five or top 10 of the year. And part of that discussion is, you know, at least from my perspective, because I agreed with you and I also didn't really like that movie, but that there
Tree
was,
of Life.
Right. Tree of Life. Yeah. Sorry. That he really had these great moments in it. And I think that, but when you watch the whole movie, it didn't, at least for me, that Tree of Life did not work as a whole movie, but these really brilliant moments came out of it. And I think that's sort of the opposite for me for Boyhood. Like the moments, the individual moments, the scenes, I think a lot of them were brilliant, but a lot of them were not. And what I got out of this movie from an emotional level really had to do with the gimmick. And I for the most part didn't find those flaws that distracting, but I think that it kept it from being the 100 score on Metacritic perfect movie for me.
But I think as far as Linklater is concerned, and I think he should win Best Director when it comes to the Oscars. I think it takes just as much talent, if not more, to be a non-show me director as compared to a show me director.
If
Wes Anderson won for Grand Budapest Hotel, I'd be excited. Because I think that's an unbelievably directed movie, but that's like a show me director. That's a very stylized, this is what I'm going to do sort of director. And this is the polar opposite Anderson. Of that. But I think they're both great filmmakers.
Yeah,
and I think,
sorry, I think I misspoke. So I like the hands off directors. Those are my favorite ones. Those are the ones I love. And I that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is I think that the power of this movie comes from the collective, the whole, you know, looking the entire experience, the fact that it was this growth and the change over time. And, but the smaller there, but you know, within that little time frame, there were moments that did not work for me, that were not effective. And I thought were hackneyed and a little bit, you know, acting here and there, certain scenes, the writing, etc. And I guess what my point is that those scenes kept this from being the perfect movie for me. I mean, I still really liked it. And I think more than liking it, and we've said this before, I sort of appreciate it. Like I really appreciate what he did. And I think you're right. I think he deserves to be best director because, I mean, you know, we talked about this on the Fixies 2 years ago. Sorry, I just listened to that episode, so I hope it's okay that I'm referencing it. But we talked about, you know, how,
referencing our own podcast,
right?
I mean, we have the rights to it, so it's okay.
We you know that. Sorry, now I'm forgetting what I'm saying. So, we talked about like the different elements and do we evaluate movies collectively? Do we evaluate director? I think one of the things we debated was whether how can you have how can there be a distinction between the best picture and the best director category? And I think that that's clear. I think Boyhood is a perfect example of that, because I think Richard Linklater, this is a brilliant piece of directing. It's a brilliant idea. It's a brilliant concept. The elements that didn't work for me were more in the writing and the acting. And so I totally agree with you, Jeremy. I think he does deserve that. But it's not the perfect movie. It's not the perfect movie for me, at least. And those are the reasons.
I mean, I think, you know, throwing around the term perfect is dangerous. I mean, you know, you look at 100-point Metascore, and obviously that's going to spawn that discussion. But I mean, I would not argue that. I wouldn't suggest that this is a perfect movie. I mean, there were scenes that I don't think worked, like the scene towards the end when the former plumber turned, you know, restaurant manager comes up and says how Patricia Arquette changed his life. I thought was totally forced and
really
and unnecessary.
I can see why you said that, though.
But there's scenes like that. There are little bits and pieces scattered throughout the movie like that, that I think, you know, if we're talking perfect movie, and you know, it would be a whole nother discussion to argue if that even exists. But you can find flaws in any movie. Sure. And I think it's important. And you did mention this, that, you know, it's at least not the perfect movie for you, because I think there's a distinction there. And I think for me, this movie just, I mean, it spoke to me on so many different levels. I found it relatable. I found it entertaining. I found it powerful and dramatic. And that's why it just it stands alone above, you know, the hundreds of movies I've probably seen in the last, you know, whatever, 5, 10 years, wherever it's. I don't have it specifically ranked, but it ranks in the top five of movies I've seen in the last decade.
Wow. We're talking about The Interview, right?
We moved on.
Okay, good.
I have full confidence in saying that, because it's just a movie that I've seen twice, but even if I'd only seen, I've not stopped thinking about it for days and weeks now. And it's unusual that a movie has such a long lasting impact on
me. Right.
So, you know, there's lots of parts of this movie that,
I mean,
my critic's hat on as a film critic, I can say this didn't work, or this wasn't done well, or the acting was bad. But, you know, from an audience member, like, I just, there's no convincing me that this movie was not just unbelievably good.
This war, we're not winning it. If you speak a word of what I'm about to show you, you will be executed for high treason.
It's beautiful. It's the greatest encryption device in history, and the Germans use it for all communications.
Everyone thinks Enigma is unbreakable.
Let me try, and we'll know for sure.
Mr. Turing, do you know how many died because of it?
I don't.
3. While we've been having this conversation.
I feel like this movie could have been 2 different movies. You could have had the movie about solving this code, and you also could have had a movie about Alan Turing.
Right, right.
Living in that day and age and you know, being a brilliant person, but having to deal with his struggles. And I kind of think that this movie did a pretty good job of combining the two, but I also think it left a little bit to be desired on both fronts.
Oh, I think it left so much. I mean, I enjoyed the movie, but I like wanted to see this movie. I wanted to see either the documentary on this guy, or I wanted to see this movie really
taken seriously.
Take the whole thing seriously and like go in depth with this guy, because it's one of the most amazing stories I've ever heard in my life, and I still walked away from the theater going, that movie was just and I was just like, are you kidding me? This guy makes Oscar Schindler look like chump change, because he's, you know, ultimately saved millions of people's lives, and then he himself was such an interesting character, and how he lived was so interesting, and how he died was so interesting. It was so, like, everything was so fascinating on the surface, and then they give you this sort of watered down, paint by numbers, here you go, this is kind of what happened, but it was much more interesting in real life.
Right
Yeah, I think that's my point, in that this solving the code, that movie could be brilliant. It's like, that could be a movie in and of itself. And then,
but
the
didn't
documentary,
you want to see it all?
Turing,
didn't you just want to?
No, I really
like,
did. And I'm totally with you. And I think, just based on our kind of initial reactions, that I left the movie a little bit more satisfied than you guys did. But I think my satisfaction was based on the exact same things that you guys were. Like, I liked the same reason you liked the movie. I think I just liked it a little bit more, but right. I was hoping for all the same things that you guys were. Like, I think there's so much there, and like, you could have just had a movie about this character in general, or movie just about breaking the code, or a documentary even. Like, it made you want to read up on who he was, but you know, the movie could have done that instead, you know, and then you wouldn't have had to.
Yeah, to plagiarize again and steal some other person's words. A.O. Scott said, "The Imitation Game is a highly conventional movie about a profoundly unusual man. This is not entirely a bad thing." So, you know, you don't really have to listen to these podcasts anymore, because we're just going to just go to the Metacritic page for any given movie.
And just read the little snippets that they have.
But you know what? I feel like this is such a trend, and it's almost... It's like every year, or once in a, maybe not every year, but once in a maybe every other Academy Award year, there's at least one movie, often a couple, that are just, you know, kind of middle of the road, kind of like he said, conventionally produced movies that get all this attention because they've either got like a really great performance, or I mean, this movie is nominated for Best Picture, for Christ's sakes, and like it's so not worth that. I mean, it's, you know,
a lot of people I've read it a couple times that it's the King's Speech of this year.
Right. And I mean, the King's Speech won, and this won't win, but you know, there's like the Theory of Everything is also one of those type of movies.
Yeah, they can't. Yeah.
And it's like,
I haven't seen that yet though.
I don't know. I mean, maybe we just finished a movie that requires you to sort of lean forward and really be invested in a movie, and it's 2.5 hours, you know, it's 2 hours and it's almost 3 hours long, and
couldn't quite do the math there.
Sorry. And then you switch to this, which is nominated in the same category, and it's a movie that just that is so easy to absorb. It's like it doesn't require anything of the viewer. It doesn't, you know, it's doing really well. It's made a lot more money than Boyhood has. I wonder if, like, you know, sometimes this is just the way, you know, these are just sort of easily constructed for the easiest digestion by the core audience, the John Q public, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely the case, and it's such, like, with this movie, I've never felt like anything like that has been such a disservice before as this one was, because you wanted to be like, I kept trying to grasp onto, I kept like all these scenes when they were like even in the bars and you know, talking to each other. I felt they were just written. I just felt like these were people from that time period that Hollywood screenwriters decided that this is what they do. And so here they are. I wanted the real thing. I wanted it so bad with this movie because it's such an interesting life story. And you just wanted to actually be there. You wanted to experience it. And it left you going, oh, are you kidding me? Like, ugh.
But do you, and it, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and it wasn't even from lack of talent from the actors, especially, Cumberbatch, who was, I thought, was phenomenal in this movie, but imagine if he had the screenplay to work with.
I think it's interesting that it's a kind of a critical term that you don't really hear very often. You just said it, that I think is very, very, a very good point to make, that this movie felt written. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
Overproduced on every level, and it's like, it's sort of what happens when you start getting too much money, and then you go and you hire a good writer, and then they feel obligated to put together something that's going to be Oscar worthy, and then you go and you hire some great costume people and set decorators,
and then you go and get Morton Tilden,
who
the director who's nominated for this, for Christ's sakes.
Oh, God.
Morton Tilden.
And you get this very glossy, pretty sort of, I guess it's a very Hollywood movie, but you don't get the story. You don't get the story you want.
And nothing stands out. I mean, you look at the other people nominated in this category and you see, you know, Wes Anderson. I wasn't the biggest fan of Grand Budapest Hotel, but I mean, that's a vision at least. That's a vision right there. I mean,
yeah,
you know, this movie,
whether you like it or not, you're like amazed by it.
Right. And that's so true. As a side note, I've seen it. It's been on HBO a couple times, and I just have to watch it when I turn it on. And I absolutely like did not. I couldn't get out of the theater quick enough when I was seeing it. But anyways, it's like it's almost as if, you know, he stepped back and tried to want the story to tell itself, but you got to do a little bit of, you know, you got to do something significant. You're making a movie here, for Christ's sakes. Wake up.
Well, so, I mean, yeah. You have to kind of wonder, you know, we're talking, I haven't seen Grand Budapest Hotel, but I mean, you're talking about the difference between a Wes Anderson written and directed movie and a Morton Tilden directed movie produced by Harvey Weinstein. You know what I mean? So, I mean, we're dealing with kind of pretty much the polar opposites of what we get in Hollywood today. And I mean, look, if Harvey Weinstein produces a movie that's released in November, chances are it's going to be something along these lines that's, you know, lines up with everything that the Academy is looking for to win an Oscar.
Yeah.
And, right. You know, who do we fault for that? Or do we fault somebody or are our expectations too high? You know, it's kind of a tricky situation.
And I think you hit the nail on the head, Chavin, when you said that, that they kind of like, they have this story and they just don't want to, in a way, like they don't want to screw with it. They go, this story's great. I'm just going to present it to you how it is. But I think that's such an injustice to the story. I mean, like, show me it. Show me this story. Bring me into that world. Like give me the thing that you fell in love with this story. Show that to me. Instead, it's kind of like, all right, we have this unbelievable story. We have this group, you know, these great actors, and we have this great talent surrounding, great crew. Let's just sort of let's just take a step back because we know the story's good, and then just give the audience that. And I think that's, like I said, I think that's such an injustice to a story like this.
Yeah, it's almost extraordinary how they weren't able to tell a compelling story with this material. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that's kind of the point, and it goes back to what you said, Jeremy, is that they tried to tell the story. They didn't show it to us. They didn't let it unfold. They didn't let it evolve. They just kind of tried to tell the story as if we were reading it on Wikipedia.
Exactly, and it's like, okay, we got Cumberbatch, you got it. You know what you're doing. Okay, good. All right, so you know, let's throw Keira Knightley in here, who was just, you know, she was fine, she was serviceable, but you know what you're doing. Okay, great. All right, so I'm just gonna, you know, we got our perfect script. All right, we're gonna show that. And it's like, all right, so we're not gonna really ultimately give me anything. You're just gonna give me the surface of it. And it's like, I don't know, I would love to see a different director take this material, and I'd watch that movie if, like, you know, you got Scorsese or somebody else to direct it, because I think there's something great here.
It's interesting because I totally agree with everything you guys have said, and I agree that in that sense this movie is disappointing. And I'm trying to think of a time where I've liked a movie as much as I liked this, but was also at the same time really disappointed in what it was, because
it's almost hard not to like, because it's so interesting. It's like a really interesting story.
And I think there were a lot of things that were done well in it. Like I said, like, I do think that he did a good, I do wish it explored more of, or either of either Alan Turing, or explored more of the cracking the Enigma code. But I do think that it kind of balanced the two together well. And then the acting was good. There was a lot about this movie that I think was good, you know, but, you know, what we have focused on is just like the huge miss in this movie and totally failing to elaborate and really show us the inside details of this story, which is ultimately what made it disappointing.
Yeah, I think ultimately they just played it safe. And it was,
I think that's a really good way to say it. Yeah, they played it safe, which didn't make it a bad movie, but it left a lot to be desired. Or it almost kind of, the thing is that, like, I never would have I never would have thought I was missing out on anything had they not played this safe. You know what I mean? Like, if, like, had I never seen this movie, or if this movie totally sucked, I don't think I would have felt like I was missing out on something better. But because it was kind of done well but played safe, I saw what it could have been.
Blow on them.
Huh?
Go ahead. Blow.
You want me to blow on your toes?
Uh-huh. I can't blow that far.
Are you sure he won't mind?
Billy doesn't care about anything. He's a nihilist.
Oh, that must be exhausting.
You're not blowing.
Our guest has to be getting along, Mrs. Lebowski.
Oh, your bunny.
I'll suck your cock for $1,000.
Wonderful woman. We're all very fond of her, very free-spirited.
Brand can't watch, though, or he has to pay $100.
No. That's marvelous.
I'm just going to go find a cash machine.
So there's the top five performances from actors we don't like, and I'm calling it the Ethan Hawke, my Ethan Hawke memorial list. So I'll go first, and I'll kind of explain my criteria. So my specific criteria was that it had to be, it couldn't be an actor that I liked, or it couldn't be an actor that I liked, and then now I don't like them now because of bad. Like, I liked them for a good performance, and now I don't like them now because they're bad. So, for example, Kate Hudson, I liked for Almost Famous, but I don't like now because she hasn't done anything good since.
But the reason
I liked her was because of Almost Famous. So it has to go the other direction. It has to be an actor I didn't like until I saw them in this performance.
Got it.
And whether or not I like them now, or whether or not I like them now or don't like them now, doesn't matter. And then the way I kind of tried to rank it was based on a little bit of how much I like them now since that performance.
Okay.
If that makes sense.
I think you just made it more confusing, but why not?
Whatever.
You give us your number five.
So how I rank them, it doesn't matter. I was going back and forth on my number five because one of them is a TV performance, but I'm going to go with it as my number five. And that's Zach Braff. And I never liked him in anything except for Arrested Development.
Wow, that's pulling. Yeah, okay.
I was going back and forth between him and Katherine Heigl and Knocked Up.
But I don't think I like him in Arrested Development. I think he's just
so
terrible.
Funny in that, though.
Okay, Jeremy, do you want to go?
Okay, sure. So because this was so confusing to me, I just went with actors I still don't like. And then
it was hard because actors I don't like, I couldn't find movies that I liked.
And then the event, they gave like one decent performance or good performance, but it's not like any of these actors I'm going to go run out to the theater and see.
Okay.
So maybe number five is a little obvious, but I have to go with it because I've never seen another movie I liked with this guy before, really, or since. And it is Cuba Gooding Jr. in Jerry Maguire.
Okay. That's a good one.
Yeah. I thought about that. I don't think I ever really had an opinion on him at all ever. So it was kind of a hard one for me to go with.
Okay. So, yes, I think this was a very interesting category I have 18, I have 18 honorable mentions that didn't make the list. So my criteria were, I had the same issue. I didn't know exactly how to rank them and how to organize it. So I made my own decision. And basically what I did was I only really did actors who I genuinely like do not look forward to them being in a movie and I almost try to avoid. And actually, I found that to be a difficult people to find. I think most people I actually like, which is sort of strange. But anyways, so then based on that, so let me rephrase. So the people who made the top five were all people who I don't like as actors. And then I ranked them based on the ratio of how much I don't like them to how much I like their performance. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of what okay. I did.
So
I think that might be what I did. I don't know how mine's ranked, actually.
Okay. Looking at so it. My number five is Taya Leone in Ghost Town.
Wow. Okay.
I can't remember that movie.
I'm trying to think of another movie she's in.
Well, she's in plenty.
And I'll Deep continue
Impact. Deep Impact. The only thing else,
Adam Sandler movie. You know,
Spanglish. She was. I thought she was charming, and she was. Which I don't think she is in a lot of other movies, which is interesting for a attractive blonde woman. But,
she's kind of boring.
Yeah, she's boring, and I think she's like grating and kind of annoying most of the time. But. I thought she was charming, and you could understand why Ricky Gervais's character fell in love with her. And then on the opposite side,
well, look at Ricky Gervais.
She was also quite convincing in believing that she could fall in love with Ricky Gervais.
Oscar.
So that's my number five. Lee, back to you.
Is it my turn?
It's your turn.
All right. My number four is kind of an interesting one because it's an actor, and Jeremy, you may remember this or not, but it's an actor that I don't really even know why I never liked, I never thought was funny for like years, and now I'm just totally on the other side of the spectrum now, even though some of the stuff he does is not I'm not totally enamored with, but it's Will Ferrell in Old School.
That's a good pick, I think.
Now, I don't know that that's a particularly great performance, but I just thought he was really funny in that movie.
Him doing what he does, so.
What he does, exactly. And what he does, for whatever reason, before that, I never liked. I never thought it was funny, and I didn't like. And even now, it's weird, because I go back and look at the stuff I didn't like, and now I think it's funny. So I don't know what was the matter with me.
I definitely gave that some consideration, and I totally think that's a great pick. Jeremy, what do you think? I mean, Jeremy, what's your number four?
We don't care what you think.
So my number four is an actor that is an actor I don't know in too much stuff, but I never thought he was terribly good, but I think he's pretty okay in this movie.
Stiff criteria. Yeah, all they had to do was be pretty okay.
I mean, he doesn't have a huge role or anything, but and it's Abe Vigoda in The Godfather.
Good. That's what else is admitted?
Good Burger and Conan O'Brien sketches.
Oh, I know
sketches.
Who you're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I know who you're talking
He's
about.
He's in a looks the same age as he looked in The Godfather.
Yeah.
He got to a certain, like, age of, like, 72 and never aged anymore.
Yeah.
He turned 72 in 72 and then didn't age ever.
And then that was it. And now he does Conan O'Brien skits in Good Burger. And I'm like, whenever I see him in The Godfather, I'm like, that guy.
That's funny.
Okay. My number four, an actor I think you guys will all agree with me here on not liking, and that's Tobey Maguire in Brothers.
Okay, my number three, it's kind of an unusual pick, but I think it mostly because it's not so much that I didn't like this particular person as an actor as much as it was I just never gave them any thought and almost didn't really consider them a real actor. But it's Zac Efron in Neighbors, who, again, like I said, I never even gave him a second thought and thought he was kind of a pointless person. But I thought he's so funny in that movie. And now I kind of just laugh when I see him because he had those movies where he was just like, seemed like he just wanted to take his shirt off and show his abs, but they totally play on that as a joke in Neighbors, and it just cracks me up. And that movie wasn't great; it was funny at times, but just I think the surprise of how much I liked him in that movie is what earned him a spot on the list.
Interesting pick.
All right, so my number three is sort of my more obvious choice, I guess, but there's not a movie I look forward to with him in. There's a couple performances I like, but this was the first one that I was like, okay, now I'm interested, and it's Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah, that was that's.
Yeah, I thought about him too. I don't know that I don't know if I dislike Adam Sandler as much as I'm just annoyed by his what he's decided to do with his career.
Right. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are those comedians who have a certain role, and Eddie Murphy comes to mind, for example, of who just sort of do what they do, even though they've got a tremendous amount of talent, but pays the bills, I guess. All right, my number three is, so this is an actor who actually, I'm not sure I've seen him in anything else, but I know, I just hate him. I hate what he represents, and I hate the little clips that I've seen of him doing, but I thought he was the best part of this movie, and that's Tyler Perry in Gone Girl.
Oh, what a great pick. Yeah. That should be on my list.
Yeah, he was.
That's
really
a great
good
pick.
Yeah, I didn't even think about that.
You win.
Podcast signing over. All right, my number two, I think, is a little bit of an obvious pick, and it kind of sums up actor I hated, now I like, and I think a lot of people could maybe argue that this is the case with this actor, but it's Bradley Cooper, and I went with Silver Linings Playbook as the movie that kind of turned the tide for me, a good performance from him. But I just, oh my, I hated him up to that movie.
You and me both, buddy.
I definitely echo that. I don't know if he's earned my respect completely after that either. He's someone I might still dislike, but
well, and I remember having a conversation with you, Jeremy, about Bradley Cooper, and we kind of said, and it was a little bit of a, you could consider us prophets in a sense, that we said that, like, you know, he might be a fine actor, but he's not a comedic actor. And I think maybe that was a little bit of the problem, is he kept showing up in movies like Wedding Crashers and The Hangover, and he was not funny. He was just annoying and, like, smug and uncomfortable to watch and just kind of sucked. But then you kind of, you know, you put him in something a little bit more serious, and you know, he kind of showed off his chops a little bit, I think.
My number two is actress I really dislike, but I like her in this movie, and it's Kristen Stewart in Adventureland.
Yep, I knew that was gonna be on somebody's list.
I thought about that. Kristen Stewart in Adventureland, that was kind of my first foray with her, so that kind of fell into the same thing as Kate Hudson. Like, that was my kind of first experience with her.
Yeah, I don't mind her enough for that to be on my list, but yeah, she was good in that. Okay, my number two is a movie we discussed on this podcast, but that's Brad Pitt in Tree of Life. I really just don't think that Brad Pitt is a very good actor. He's not someone I go, oh, he's in that movie and I'm not going to see it because of it. I think he's got a lot of clout, and he's done some good things with his celebrity and his Hollywood power. But for the most part, he just kind of doesn't live up to the hype. And
what's in the box? Well, what's in the box?
Those are exceptions, I suppose. But yeah, again, like Tree of Life, he just kind of, and
what's in the fucking box?
What's in the box?
Ours was better.
Yeah, he sounded like Tarzan.
I don't know if yours was any better.
It's getting so late.
Okay, sorry. So yes, so Tree of Life. I really thought that was a standout performance, and that's all there is to be said.
All right, my number one is the reason I don't know if I ever really disliked this actor. It's more that I didn't think he was any good based on kind of the first movie I really kind of saw him in. But I've totally turned the page on him. I love this actor now. And the movies that I went with kind of tied. But it is Mark Ruffalo, not liking him based on his performance in Collateral, but then liking him based on his performance in, I went with Zodiac and or Shutter Island.
Yeah, Mark Ruffalo was on my list, but like, and I used to really dislike him as well for Collateral, but he's gotten to the point where I like him so much now.
Yeah,
I couldn't put him on this list. And it was the same thing with Leonardo DiCaprio. And if I want to start putting Leo and Mark Ruffalo on a list of bad actors, it's not
fair. I think
fair.
That's another that's a different category. It's like performances.
That's why I left them off. Yeah.
That make you change your mind with someone. Okay, so my number one, and again, this is the biggest ratio to off how much I hate them to how much I love this performance, and it's Angelina Jolie in Changeling, a movie I found just
surprisingly good.
All the way through, really. I mean, I don't think it's a movie that got very good reviews, and I thought she was excellent. I thought the movie was excellent.
Yeah, I love that movie.
I
think that's the last great Clint movie.
I watched it on your recommendation, so good to know.
I own that movie. Have not watched it since I bought it. Definitely not a movie that's totally comfortable to rewatch.
Mm-hmm. Okie dokie. So anybody have any honorable mentions?
Not really. Like I said, Catherine Heigl and Leo and Mark.
I have one for you guys that I think you might find interesting. I had Tim Robbins in Shawshank Redemption. Again, he's not someone I hate, but he's not someone I at all look forward to seeing in movies.
Oh my God, whatever happened to Tim Robbins? He hasn't been in a movie in forever.
Mystic River, I think, was the last one I saw.
I really thought he was bad in that.
I thought he's fine. He's good in The Player, too.
See, I can't do Tim Robbins in Shawshank, because Shawshank was definitely the first time I ever knew who Tim Robbins was, but, you know, and obviously one of my favorite movies ever. I was trying to come up with I really wanted to come up with a movie on this list with Maggie Gyllenhaal, but she's never been good in anything.
Yeah, you really hate her, huh?
God, she's so bad. Like, I'd say she's so bad. And her brother is so good. Like, I watched Nightcrawler the other day, which you guys should definitely check out.
All right. Okay, we should wrap this one up. I got to get up in a few hours.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Well, that's been the Get Your Film Fix podcast.
2.0.
We'll come up with a better name, or we'll stop saying that at some point.
I'm staying. I'm finishing my coffee. Enjoying my coffee.
Lee, we put that in post-production now. That's part of the revive. We don't have to sing the theme song anymore.
Part of the 2.0. Yeah.